My name is Tim Kay. I represent Mr. Oakley in this particular case. My office is in Brookville, Wisconsin, and I'd like to thank the justices for their time and consideration of this case today, and for the written arguments that we submitted and the oral arguments that we're about to present. In the beginning, when I first reviewed this case, there was something strange about this case. As the justices may recall, that from the very onset, Sheboygan trial judge John Murphy referred and imposed something that was not before him without judicial notice, without notice to the parties, and without any motion, and he imposed that something as a condition of probation for a felony criminal conviction for witness intimidation. Now, this something was an unrelated fine for municipal forfeitures in 1993 for a disorderly conduct city of Sheboygan matter and a 1989 county forfeiture ordinance. Mind you, none of these fines that the trial court imposed had anything to do with the victim in the witness intimidation case, had nothing to deter him from any further criminal activity in that case, and had nothing to do with the fact that he was convicted in that trial court for felony intimidation. It was so strange that I immediately tried to obtain the Supreme Court records and eventually did find those records, motioned the trial court, and eventually motioned the Court of Appeals, had the records supplemented, and now it's clear that these are a disorderly conduct type matter and a OER matter in which Judge Murphy bootlegged or strapped into the felony case. It's actually a very simple case once you get beyond these facts. It's really a case between two competing statutes, 973.09, which is the imposition of probation, and 973.07, which is failure to pay fines. It's actually a case of first impression for this court in this state. It hasn't been addressed or at least written about at the appellate level or the Supreme Court level. And
can I just interrupt you a moment? Is it your position that if he did not pay restitution, it would be a violation of probation and he'd be subject to, what was it, 10 years in prison?
If restitution was imposed and he did not pay that, yes. In this particular
case? In this case?
That could happen to him.
Why is that when I think there was something in the record when he would receive if he didn't pay 96-day jail sentence or something like that?
I believe on the motion for post-conviction relief, the trial judge indicated that there was a 96-day time period. It was unclear as to why the trial court brought up the 96 days. In the original docket entries, it showed that the alternative for failing to pay would have been, or could have been, 200 days. I think what the trial judge did is recognize that that may have been excessive, and he probably took the amount of fine, which totals $2,602, which is the total of the two municipal ones. He probably divided by 25, which
that's
is the cost.
I just factored that $25 a day.
Yeah. And it roughly comes out, it actually comes out to 104 days, but maybe the mathematical computations was...
So is your answer to my question that he'd only spend that limited amount of time in the jail if
no.
he because, didn't pay restitution rather than forfeit probation?
On the fine part, he would not just spend 96 days in jail because the trial judge did not modify or change the original sentence that was imposed in the civil cases. Okay? It seemed the trial court was trying to modify these prior disorderly conduct and prior OER matter in the context of the felony case. But the real sanction would be that if he did not pay his fines, his probation would be revoked, and quite clearly, either in my view expressly or impliedly, the way the Attorney General's office looks at it, but quite clearly in my view, this fellow would be going to prison for 10 years. Trial judge told him, if you don't pay your financial obligations, you are going to prison for 10 years, straight from here, straight to there. There doesn't seem to be much of a debate in that court's mind.
So this was not imposed as a rehabilitative condition, but just to up the ante, penalty for collection of the fines?
Correct. I believe that that's exactly what the trial judge had done in that particular instance, was to penalize this defendant for not paying his 1989-1993 obligations.
So the originally imposed jail alternative to the fine wasn't enough to motivate your client, and the trial judge wanted to give him a stiffer motivation?
I think my client needs lots of motivation, but...
as is often the case.
He just has a hard time with things, but...
apparently so.
Whether the trial court sought to really rehabilitate him by imposing this as a condition of probation, I would submit that the trial court was actually penalizing Mr. Oakley rather than trying to rehabilitate him.
Counsel, I'm somewhat confused by some of the initial statements you make in your argument section of your brief. I'm referring to the bottom of page 3 and the bottom of page 4. You can grab your brief for a second, because I want to understand your argument.
Yes.
You say at the last line of page 3, it is the petitioner's position that the fine sought to be imposed must be related to the underlying crime of conviction. Then at the bottom of page 4, you say, petitioner concedes that Wisconsin case law allows conditions of probation to be imposed against the defendant that are unrelated to the crime of conviction. Those seem to me irreconcilable, but maybe they're not. What do you mean by that?
The way I divide it up in my mind, and when I try to write these, prepare for today, is I made two sides of the ledger, okay? And on one side of the ledger, I have cases that talk about rehabilitation, which are specifically geared to that defendant. And that would be the Brown case, the Hayden case, the Gonzalez case, and the Beersdorf case. In those cases, the court imposed conditions of probation that were designed specifically to rehabilitate that defendant for his criminal conduct or to help the victim in some manner. In the other cases, the Miller case, the Neinhardt case, and the Edwards case, and the James P. case, in those cases, the courts imposed unrelated conditions because the theory was that it would prohibit that particular defendant from engaging in further criminal activity. So, in one sense, you can impose a condition to rehabilitate if it's related to that defendant, you know, therapy classes, restitution, whatever, unrelated if it's going to prohibit that fellow from doing criminal activities such as making harassing telephone calls, staying in a local township area that may cause that defendant to run into a victim and whatnot. So, there is a distinction. Making it clearer, but so in some sense, you can pose related conditions and unrelated. In this case, paying municipal county forfeitures serves neither. It's not related to his drug rehabilitation because he's convicted for criminal felony intimidation. OAR and disorderly conduct has nothing to do with that. And we have no idea what the D.C. was all about. I mean, arguably, there could have been some connection between the disorderly conduct and the witness intimidation, but we don't know that. It's not part of the record. We just have the fines that the court talked about.
Are you saying, because I need some assistance on this, are you saying it can be related to the rehabilitation? It can be related to the offense? And those are fine, appropriate.
Yes.
Even though if it's related to the rehabilitation, it does not have to be directly related to the offense.
Correct.
But in this instance, you're arguing that it is neither. It is neither related to rehabilitation nor related to the offense.
Correct.
Thank you.
Simply paying a fine on OAR has nothing to do with prohibiting him from engaging in intimidation of a witness.
Mr. Kay, didn't the trial judge make some statements at the time he was imposing these conditions about a need for this defendant to have some respect for authority and for the judicial system?
Yes, he did.
Don't those things tie into rehabilitation?
They do if they are reasonable with respect to conditions for that offense. I think paying unrelated fines goes too far. I think it puts the trial court in a position of being a collection agency for the county or for the city of Sheboygan. There's other avenues for the county and city to pursue and obtain their forfeitures, and not through probation in this case. But the trial court did make, there must have been some prior encounters between that bench and that defendant, because it seems from the record that they were somewhat familiar with each other. So maybe the court was doing commonly what is thought of as doing something good for that particular defendant, but in the end, it was something, a condition that was imposed that was not contemplated by the defense counsel, not contemplated by the DA, was not asked for. Gosh knows how the trial court became aware of these outstanding forfeitures and then just imposed them.
Well, maybe he got it up on the record. As you said, he had familiarity with this particular individual. Was he the judge in prior cases?
I don't know. The only records that we received from Sheboygan were the, which I supplemented, were the actual citations and the court minute sheets.
For this offense, could the judge have imposed a fine for this offense?
Yes, exactly. That's an excellent point. In the judgment of conviction, the judge imposed a fine of $10. And if the court really wanted to make payment of a fine, a rehabilitation method, the court could have simply said, I'm going to impose a fine of $2,800. Or $3,000, up to $10,000 was his limit, and the court did not.
But the court could have.
The court could have.
And if the court had imposed a $10,000 fine as a condition of probation, that would have been all right?
That would have been entirely in the court's discretion. You probably would have been complaining about excessiveness, but that is entirely appropriate.
And then he doesn't pay it again. Then what does the state do? And then he's arrested 2 months down the line and still hasn't paid the fine. For a different offense. And maybe that conduct repeats itself 5-6 times. And he admits that he just has no respect for the system.
Well, I actually make a point or a short argument that in our system and in our state and in our country, you can actually be belligerent. You can be non-compliant with the law, and that is a person's right. They can take the alternative for not paying, which would be revocation of their probation, or take the jail alternative.
So you're saying that the statutes that allow, that give the state the right to recover, you know, the state has to follow certain processes to recover these. These are exclusive remedies for it.
Yes. Under 973.07, there's a provision that the alternative for not paying a forfeiture, whether it's $10 or $10,000, the maximum alternative is 6 months. That is one penalty the court could impose. The other penalties are under Section 6612, which are the procedures for the county and the city to turn a civil-type forfeiture into a civil judgment and, you know, either garnish wages and whatnot that way.
If he takes, just for clarification, if he takes the alternative under 973.07 and gives a maximum of 6 months, the fine is still owed at the end of the six-month period?
I don't believe so. I believe that once you serve the alternative for not paying, when you do those 6 months, that is, you're paying your debt to society, you're paying a $10,000 fine. That would... you may need some further clarification by a motion in front of the court to remind the court that fine was served, the alternative was imposed and completed, therefore the judgment should be Thank you.
Mr. Kane, was there ever a claim by your client that these fines were excessive, that he couldn't afford to pay these fines?
In this case, no. There was no specific statements by him or his counsel in the trial court that it was too much.
And that would be true both on the disorderly conduct and the OAR?
I'm not sure what he... I didn't represent him in that DC, in that OAR, and I'm not... I don't know what the record was in those cases.
But to the best of your knowledge, there was no claim made of indigency or inability to pay?
That's correct.
So, in the Hain case, or however one pronounces it, you cite the Hain case as supporting your position. But now, as I recall, that was the burglar system case.
Yes.
It was a burglar alarm.
Yes.
And there was a specific statute, just as there is here, that allowed methods of forcing restitution on a defendant.
Correct.
And the sentencing court did not use those statutes, but rather imposed this as a condition of probation that he paid for a burglar system.
Correct.
So now, why is it, you stated to me a couple minutes ago that these statutes that allow collection of fines are exclusive, and yet we found in Hain that they're not, that the restitution statutes are not exclusive.
I may be speaking out of turn, but I believe in the Hain case, the issue was between subsection 1A and 1B. If you impose the conditional probation under 1B as a term of restitution, that's a different animal. If you impose it under 1A as any condition which is reasonable, that is a separate...
In that case, they didn't fit restitution.
Correct.
And so,
because it was a subsequent purchase of a new system, so it wasn't replacing the old system.
And the court said that the fact that this looked like restitution but didn't fit restitution, that statute providing for restitution didn't bar a reasonable condition of probation.
Yes, that's what the majority indicated. I'll mention that, correct, under 97309, sub A, I would agree and submit that the court or a trial court may impose any condition which appears to be reasonable, but in this case, with the imposition of unrelated fines, these unrelated fines do not fit under 1B for restitution, 1G, for example, costs for legal representation, 1X, for some kind of a crime prevention organization, or sub 4 human facilities, or 7M, which is community service. And the point I'm trying to make is that unrelated fines don't fit under 97309 because the legislature intended that they not fit under there. The legislature intended that if you don't pay fines, you go under 97307. Court follows the imposition of the alternative, which presumably could get to 6 months. In this case, it just seems that it seems to be a pretty knowledgeable assumption that Mr. Oakley will probably not pay these fines. He will probably be revoked, and when he's revoked, he's not subject to the alternative of just 6 months for not paying the fines. He will be subject to the maximum of 10 years. And I'd like to preface that 10 years, in the trial record and in most of the briefs, we all refer to 10 years because I believe that's what the trial court mentioned. Actually, he's convicted of a Class D felony, which is only 5 years. So even though there's references to 10 years, it may actually only be 5 years, but 5 years, 10 years prison certainly is a lot more than several months in county jail.
Mr. Kay, do you think that the fact that there apparently was an alternative sentence imposed would have some effect on whether or not, indeed, now with a revocation, he could be sentenced for failure to pay those fines to 5 years or 10 years? In other words, can a strong argument be made that that can't happen because an alternative sentence was already imposed?
It's not clear that the trial court stated that 96 days was the alternative for failing to pay these municipal forfeitures. And if the court was stating that, I don't see how the court could make that conclusion because those matters were not before the court. They were motioned in. The court wasn't asked to take judicial notice of it. The DA didn't make a mention of it. It just happened. Came out of the blue.
How is it that the trial court had these fines, the existence of these fines, in front of him at the time of the plea and sentencing in the first place? It wasn't a part of any plea negotiation. It wasn't a case that was, you know, going to be somehow read in or that was mentioned in any sentencing argument or anything of that nature.
I'm not sure. I can only speculate. I did not represent Mr. Oakley in the trial court, but I'm imagining that the trial court was probably automated. They probably had a computer screen. They could probably, within a couple of keystrokes, find a person's name and fines and be knowledgeable of that time.
Counsel, for clarification, was the 96 days alternative sentence that's been referred to under 973.07 is failure to pay fine or works to comply with certain community service work, and you and I discussed that just previously in questions, or is that something different?
I'm not sure what the trial court was.
Just as a follow-up for clarification, my understanding of the law set forth in the State versus Schumann case is after a defendant has served 6 months in jail for failure to pay a fine, the state must use other methods, such as civil collection, to collect the fine. That is under 973.07.
Correct.
So, in other words, under 973.07, they can serve the 6 months, up to 6 months in jail, but once they're out, they still have to pay the fine. That's my understanding. Do you have any authority to cite for the proposition that the fine is paid under 973.07?
I believe that just that's the way I read that, because the statute...
973.07 works, I think, that you can put them in jail up to 6 months, or if they pay the fine earlier. If they pay the fine earlier, they can get out. If they don't pay the fine until the end of 6 months, you have to release them because the theory is more than 6 months won't do any good. But then the law, as I understand State versus Schumann, is after a defendant has served the 6 months, indeed, you cannot then put him back in jail for continuing to not pay that fine. Your only remedy as a jurisdiction of a county or whatever is then a civil.
Correct. Absolutely. I would agree. And I think Schumann went further and stated that was the policy of the state, that after 6 months, it's not going to be much of a difference.
You got to let them out, but then you can only collect it. That's still there, but you can only collect it by civil remedy. You can't send them back in.
Correct.
Same.
So, I would further like to indicate that the payment of these, or the imposition of these non-related fines, seems to be something that occurs fairly frequently in the Sheboygan trial court setting. The judge also indicated that it was at least his policy that he likes to tack these on quite often. So it seems to be that, at least in that county and maybe throughout the state, that trial court judges may be doing this. I.e. imposing unrelated fines as a condition of probation, and if that is occurring in this case or in other cases, I believe it's something of state importance that a decision should be issued to clarify or to detour this type of practice. It's my reading that that is something that should not happen. And so I would ask the court to strike that as a condition of probation and to make it known that adding unrelated fines that are totally not similar to the crime at hand, which, for example, felony intimidation and OIR and DC are such separate animals that they should not be commingled in the context of probation.
Well, if the prior cases had been intimidating a witness and he had received a fine as well as jail time, then can payment of that fine be imposed, in your opinion, as a condition of probation in the second case?
Yes, because it would go to his rehabilitation need to deter him from further criminal activity.
It goes to rehabilitation, but then you'd have to say that the 973-09 is not exclusive. You take the position here that it's exclusive. But then you'd say, no, it's not exclusive, where there's a second related crime.
Well, correct, because there are those cases that state that a condition of probation can be imposed to deter further criminal activity, but not payment of fines doesn't deter further, for example, OIR. But if he had a prior intimidation of a witness and a second one, I could see that paying the fine in the first one would rehabilitate him on the second one as well as the first one. That would make sense. My light is red.
I know, and you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Assistant Attorney General Daniel O'Brien, representing the state.
Good morning. May it please the court. Assistant Attorney General Daniel O'Brien appears on behalf of the respondent in this action. I imagine if Judge Murphy knew then what we know now, he never would have imposed probation in this case at all, because we have a defendant who adamantly refuses to be rehabilitated. Had he told Judge Murphy that at the time of the sentencing hearing, I guarantee you Judge Murphy would not have imposed probation.
This was a plea negotiation, wasn't it? He just went along with what the attorneys were recommending, though.
Of course. But I assume the attorneys recommended this with the notion that Mr. Oakley would make a good faith effort at rehabilitation. Obviously, he hasn't. The fact is, however, that Judge Murphy did impose probation. And because he imposed probation, the starting point for the analysis in this case is the probation statute, section 973-09. And the issue before this court is whether this was a proper condition of probation, and therefore we go to 973-09 sub 1 sub 8. That statute provides that a trial judge has the discretion to impose any condition that appears to be reasonable and appropriate. It is hard to find a statute in large statute books that is broader than this statute. It is hard to find a statute that gives trial judges greater discretion than this statute. There is nothing ambiguous about the terms any reasonable and appropriate condition of probation. This court has interpreted that phrase to mean conditions that aid in the rehabilitation of the offender and protect the interests of society. We have two issues, it appears, in this case. The petitioner's argument seems to be evolving over time, but basically there are two issues here. One is whether this particular condition to pay these outstanding fines was one of these any reasonable and appropriate conditions allowed under 973-09 sub 1, in that it helped to in that the trial judge, in the exercise of discretion, believed that it would help rehabilitate Mr. Oakley and as well serve the interests of society. The second issue is whether, even assuming that is so, whether, nonetheless, this broad provision, 973.09 sub 1 sub A, is trumped by 973.05, the statute relating to fines. With respect to the first issue, does this condition help to rehabilitate the offender and protect the interests of society? I don't think there can be any serious dispute. If you look at Judge Murphy's comments, both at sentencing and at the post-conviction hearing, it is clear that he was trying to make things better for Mr. Oakley. He was telling him, you know, I could send you to jail for 96 days. I could enforce immediate payment of these fines. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to give you 3 years to pay these off. I'm going to let you go on probation. I'm going to let you pay these in installments. I want you to demonstrate to me a sense of responsibility. And in Huggett, this court said, conditions of probation designed to rehabilitate the offender are those that instill in the defendant a sense of responsibility, a desire to change old behavior patterns, and to lead a law-abiding life. That is precisely what Judge Murphy was trying to do when he told Mr. Oakley, you have these outstanding debts to society. It is now time to pay them. I will impose them as a condition of your probation. Demonstrate to me that you no longer have contempt for this court.
Mr. O'Brien, let me test how far you're willing to push your argument. It seems to me that a plausible argument can be made that any time a defendant fails to fulfill a condition of a prior conviction, absent a reasonable excuse, that in fact that defendant is flaunting the system, shows no respect, is by failing to fulfill that condition of probation, is doing pretty much what this defendant, you claim this defendant is doing here. So then the question becomes, is it your position that a trial court can impose any condition of a prior probation that the defendant failed to fulfill?
Of a prior probation?
Yeah. Let's say 10 years ago, a defendant was convicted, he was placed on probation, and was given 10 different things to do, and he failed to do 5 of them because he didn't think they were right.
I think there you run into difficulties relating to there's the case law that discusses what happens if a defendant is discharged from probation. And if he is discharged without any effort to enforce those unsatisfied conditions, I think the case law said that he's basically successfully, in the eyes of the law, has successfully completed probation unless that term is extended or unless there's a revocation proceeding. So I think that's I would hate to concede that cannot be imposed, because I think as I say, you start with 973.09 sub 1A and you look at the condition imposed and is it related to rehabilitation and protection of society. So I think a good argument could be made that yes, you could impose it, but I also understand the case law says if nothing is done with respect to the prior probation and it is completed, that in the eyes of the law, he is in essence successfully completed
Let's just say that to follow up on that example, that he's told to take a drug and alcohol abuse treatment or seminars, and he doesn't. And there's nothing about this particular case that has anything to do with drug and alcohol abuse, although pre-sentence report might indicate he may still have some problems, right? So, and then you're going to say, well, remember those courses we told you about 5 years ago? We want you to take them now.
Well, I don't know that is all that different from a case of, you know, where there is no prior, and
I'll change my facts so that there's nothing in this pre-sentence investigation, nothing in this record that indicates he has any drug or alcohol abuse, but the judge is nervous about that.
Well, I guess
it might be a good idea just to keep him tuned up.
I guess if there's no absolutely no basis in fact for imposing the condition, then you run into questions whether it's reasonable and appropriate under the circumstances of that particular case. Because we're talking, after all, about individualized sentencing.
I know, but there was a past problem, obviously.
Well, I think if
fines,
he has a...
There's a past problem with this guy paying a fine. It had nothing to do with this particular conduct.
In this particular case?
Yeah.
See, I disagree with that. I mean, the adamant refusal to pay court-imposed fines, even though he admits the ability to pay, is highly consistent with the conduct in the intimidation of witness case, where he went up and threatened his 12-year-old son in a courtroom immediately after he got off the witness stand in a preliminary hearing. I think that is highly consistent conduct.
Counsel, let me venture a guess, and that is that no one will care if it's highly consistent. Let me pose a hypothetical. I am a circuit court judge in Marathon County, and in the hypothetical, non-payment of fines is a real problem in that county and every other county. Now, I will have, and so will, I would guess, most judges in this state who are computerized, every defendant that I have put on probation, I'm going to have as a condition of probation that he pay his outstanding fines. That will work. You know, we're always looking for new mechanisms to get these fines paid, realizing there's a separation of powers issue, that it's really the job of the executive branch, but it has something to do with the integrity of the judicial branch. So if I follow your argument, and if I were sitting on a circuit court, and I would automatically, and we can do that, as counsel suggests, just with a push of a button. In fact, I had it done with some frequency. I would make a record, because records are important, that I'm imposing the fine for OAR that's not paid from 1991 yet in the amount of $1,275. I'm imposing the failure to stop at a stop sign from 1993 that's outstanding in the amount of $200. I'm imposing the OWI second that's outstanding in the amount of $2,000 from 1996 in this 2000 sentencing because... To do so is reasonable and appropriate, and it will help the rehabilitation of the defendant, serves the interests of the state, and aids in demonstrating respect for the court system and lack of contempt. I got a perfect collection mechanism for everyone I put on probation. In fact, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put more on probation, because some of these smaller offenses, why put them in jail for 5 days and use up the time? Put them on probation and collect all these past fines. This is the answer to my problem. Isn't that the way this is going to be used?
I don't know. I would suggest if a defendant committed a felony murder, you're not going to put him on probation and collect a $200 fine from 5 years ago.
I agree with felony murder, but give me something a little less.
Like intimidation of a witness.
Which shows
contempt for the court. I mean, we do have to individualize sentencing. I understand that. And therefore, a broad brush approach like that, I am uncomfortable with. However, a defendant who has the ability to pay a fine and simply refuses, obviously is a defendant who is not rehabilitated.
Oh, but counsel, look at that State versus Will case. You can find anyone has the ability to pay a fine. Remember all that? They had cigarettes and the guy spent, how much was it? You tell me, $2 a week on cigarettes, and the court said, well, if he can afford to spend $2 a week on a cigarette habit, he can afford to pay fines, and that's all he needed to show. A couple bucks a week, and it might be less, because it's kind of an old thing. I mean, you can find ability to pay in almost anything. If they can buy cigarettes, they can pay.
Well, then, if the defendant has the ability to pay, but does not want to or refuses to pay these fines, then he should not be accepting probation in the first place. He has the right under State v. Migliorino to reject probation. And I would suggest that a defendant who accepts probation under those pretenses, knowing that he is going to persist in refusing to pay these outstanding fines is a defendant who is not an appropriate candidate for probation in the first place, and that might be an area of inquiry at the time of the sentencing hearing. Sir, you have these outstanding fines from 10 years ago. If I place you on probation and impose this condition, will you pay it? Mr. Oakley would have said no, and Judge Murphy would then have said, fine, then I am not going to impose probation. I'll send you to prison for 10 years.
Well, but maybe Mr. Oakley would have said no, but most would say, well, Judge, how long are you sending me? How long are you incarcerating me? 60 days, 120 days, 2 years. Oh, you betcha. I'll pay it.
That's fine. Yeah, I agree. And then if he doesn't, he runs the risk of revocation precisely because he agreed to that precise condition.
Like,
and I frankly don't see anything wrong with that.
I'd like to follow up on that point. What are the options if the defendant reaches the end of probation and these fines remain unpaid? What can the department do?
At that point, under whichever subset, I think it's 7309 sub 3, there's an extended provision on what happens at the end of the probation term, and the department has the option. Well,
they can refer it back to the court.
It can extend the probationary term. It can initiate revocation proceedings.
They can discharge him with the fine unpaid and forget about it.
They could. They're not supposed to. I mean, their duties under the law are to make sure that these conditions are fulfilled.
But
however, that could happen.
Doesn't it happen all the time that defendants reach the end of probation and there are some conditions that have not been fulfilled? For example, you know, they were ordered to find a job and maybe they went through the entire probation, they never found a job, but typically agents don't keep them on probation for failure to fulfill that sort of a condition, do they? And typically they don't revoke for failure to fulfill that sort of a condition either, do they?
Well, I'm not, obviously agents have some discretion in these matters. I guess in a case such as this where you clearly have a court-imposed condition, and on top of that, Judge Murphy said, I expect the probation department to report to me at the end of that term, and if there is a problem with payment, I will revisit it at that point.
Well, then what
whether he has the ability.
Okay, so let's go back to the options. Let's say we get to the end of probation, the fines are unpaid, the department can initiate revocation, they could discharge him without taking it back to court, or they could bring it back to court for an extension of probation, right? Those are basically the three options.
I believe that's correct.
Okay.
And again, he could also file a motion in the trial court to modify the conditions, independent of what the department does.
Modify the conditions to remove the fine?
Either to remove or to lessen. For instance, if you look at the comments of Judge Murphy in the post-conviction hearing, it's quite clear. He said, I will be flexible with this. If you show to me that you can't pay all of it, I'll listen to you, and I want to know why, but I'll be flexible, and maybe at the end of your term, we could reduce this. But he was leaving the door open here.
Right. No, I understand. And that's why I'm trying to identify what the various options are. They could bring it back to court to extend probation to get the fines paid. They could bring it back to court to modify the conditions of probation to either reduce the fine or to remove it as a condition to allow him to discharge altogether, because the judge would say, you've made a good faith effort, you haven't been able to secure work, you're indigent, whatever, you can't pay the fine, I'm removing it, you're discharged. Or they could initiate revocation, right?
I believe that's correct. However, that does create a problem in this case, because I think Judge Murphy made it quite clear that Mr. Oakley had the alternative of either paying the fine or serving the 96 days. So I don't know that it would be correct for the department to just automatically initiate revocation.
And why wouldn't that be? The better step
would be to take it back to the court and allow the judge to decide whether the commitment to the county jail should be made, because I think if you read Judge Murphy's remarks at the post-conviction hearing, it's pretty clear to me that he gave Mr. Oakley this alternative, so that if he continues to refuse to pay, the 96-day commitment would satisfy that condition of probation in his view.
Where does he get the authority to do that?
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at, too, by identifying what the various options are here. And I understand what the better practice would be, and I understand what Judge Murphy's expressed intent apparently was and what he was trying to accomplish. But there's nothing in the law or in this record that would... that precludes the defendant from being exposed to the full 10-year term upon revocation for failure to pay these fines.
Indeed, if he was put in jail for 96 days, you'd say that the judge didn't have the authority to do that. I mean, that may be counterproductive of going to 10 years. On the other hand, the judge might not want to put him in for 10 years.
Well,
I think that's the point of these.
Well, I think that Judge Murphy, in essence, was saying, I am giving you, at the time of sentencing, he said, I am opposing a condition of probation that you pay these outstanding fines. Now, if you do not want to, you have the option of choosing the commitment process. And any time during that probationary term.
Brian, which commitment? 96 days or 10 years?
96 days. And that any time during that probationary term, Mr. Oakley could make the decision, look, I don't want to pay this fine. And I am going to go back into court and tell the judge, or I'm going to tell my agent to go into court and tell the judge that I am choosing the alternative of the 96-day commitment instead of paying this fine.
Well, is there something in the law that says he is not exposed to the full 10 years for failure to pay the fine? And if so, I'd like to know what it is.
Well, I don't think there is. Now, on the other hand, I think there is a problem here with in reviewing the record. If you read the judge's comments, it's pretty clear what he intended, that he gave Mr. Oakley an alternative. Yes.
The point, I think, of Justice Sykes' question, if I may.
Please.
Is that, okay, so we've got a good judge here who doesn't want to go the 10 years, but you are asking us to write a decision that would allow a judge in the future to put a fellow in this kind of position away for 10 years.
I think technically that could happen, and I don't see a great problem with it, and I'll explain why. First of all, we were talking about the provision that allows the imposition of a fine as a condition of probation in general, so that if there's no prior offense, there's just, I'm going to impose a fine. As a condition of your probation in this witness intimidation offense, he can go to jail for 10 years for that if he doesn't pay that $500. And with respect to every order of probation, with respect to every defendant in the state, the defendant is told, he, as a condition of his probation, not to commit any crimes. Now, a defendant could commit a 30-day misdemeanor, spend 30 days in jail, and still be revoked and serve 10 years. So I don't know that there's that much of a distinction here in this situation. I guess I want to point out one practical problem with the record in this case. As I said, I think Judge Murphy intended to give Mr. Oakley the alternative of paying the fine or serving the commitment time. However, that is not reflected in the judgment of conviction. And the judgment of conviction simply says, pay the outstanding fines. It's one of the conditions. And I think, consistent with Judge Murphy's intent, the judgment may need to be amended, and that therefore this court may have to order a remand to allow him to amend that judgment to include the alternative so that the probation department sees, all right, at the end of the probationary term, he has not paid the fine, then he has to elect what he wants to do here. Then it would go back before Judge Murphy, and Mr. Oakley would make his decision which way he wants to go to satisfy this particular condition. I think if it's apparent from the judgment, I don't see that there's a problem. And I think the legal authority clearly exists because it's clear to everyone what the intent was, that this was an alternative way of satisfying this particular condition.
Now, as I understand it, a judge could impose a fine as a condition of probation or could just impose a fine, period, right?
Right.
The judge imposes a fine, then if there's a failure to pay that fine, I assume you would agree under 973.07, he can be put in jail for not to exceed 6 months. Is that right? Right?
Yes.
Okay. But your position then is that if it's a condition of probation, then he can put him in prison for any, up to the maximum allowed for that crime or for the revocation of probation, right?
Yes, because I think that, again, as with the restitution statutes, these are not mutually exclusive statutes. There's nothing in 973-09-1A that says, except as provided in 973-05, just as there's nothing in 973-09-1A that says, except as provided in 973-09-1B. So I think these are alternative routes. Obviously, if there's no probation involved, then you have to go under 973-05 and 973-07. If there's no probation involved, then you have to go under 973-09-1B with respect to restitution. So those statutes govern. But when a defendant is asking for probation, when a judge exercises discretion in favor of probation, that gives the judge great leeway to impose these conditions that otherwise may or may not fit under the restitution statute, may or may not fit under the fines statute, may or may not fit under the costs statute. And I think that the legislature clearly intended that when it used such broad language, again, once the decision is made to impose probation.
I'm sorry, where's the authority for imposing a fine as a condition of probation generically for the crime that's before the court?
For the crime?
For the same crime.
For the same crime. That's
imposing a fine as a condition of probation.
I wish I could give you the subsection. It's 973-05, and
Two.
Is that it? Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Thanks.
That it says that you may... I wish I had it in front. I thought I had it with me, and actually, we do
it. Great, found it. Thank you.
Yeah, and that, okay, fine, thanks. but that, that seems to recognize that this is, that, yes, regardless of the amount of the fine in that particular case, because you can make this a condition of probation, you can expose the defendant to a prison term for non-payment of the fine.
Now, counsel, with your emphasis upon what this case is all about and the fact that Judge Murphy was obviously thinking only in terms of the 96 days and not the 10 years, what is it that you want from us? Do you want a broad general holding that a judge can impose a condition of probation that would expose him to the maximum allowed under the thing that he's being convicted for, or do you want a very narrow holding that says that if they can impose it as a condition of probation, and if they fail to provide it, then they can go up to 96 days?
Well, frankly, what I would like to see is this court to simply adopt the opinion of the majority in the Court of Appeals. I thought that was a highly reasonable decision, that the conclusion that this is a reasonable and appropriate condition of probation, how could it not be, and that these statutes are not mutually exclusive. It's as simple as that. Now, if that means that under some circumstances a defendant who fails to pay outstanding fines may be exposed to a prison term, regardless of what length that is, and there's nothing to indicate that Judge Murphy would send him away for 10 years, I mean, it could very well be 1 year, or it could be...
Or he could just
choose to extend the probation.
I don't think you can just make that argument that the judge would never do it, and so therefore it's legal. Is it legal to up the ante like that?
Well, if it's legal to up the ante when you can impose a fine directly related to the offense as a condition of probation, if it's legal to up the ante for committing a misdemeanor while out on probation.
Has that statute ever been tested, the legality of that?
Not that I'm aware of. I go back to the example of the defendant who commits a disorderly conduct and is sentenced to jail for 5 days. And because of that crime, he is revoked and gets 10 years. I think case law recognizes that is proper because he could have been sentenced in that 10 years in the first place, but opted for probation. And the court, in the exercise of discretion, in the interest of rehabilitating him and helping him along, gave him an opportunity on probation, and he failed. And this is exactly what we have here. We have a failure of probation. We have a defendant who says, and it's plain as day in the reply brief, I have the constitutional right not to rehabilitate myself. Well, if a defendant says, I'm not going to rehabilitate myself, I am not going to follow the conditions of probation, he runs the risk of serving up to the maximum sentence for the intimidation of the witness offense. We're not sentencing him for the fines. We're sentencing him 10 years for intimidating a witness that he could have been imposed at the time of the sentencing, but was not, because he asked for and the judge gave him probation. And now he's saying, you know, I really wasn't a proper candidate for probation in the first place. And I think when you violate your probation, regardless of what the violation is, I think the law is pretty clear that you run the risk of getting anywhere from the minimum to the maximum for the sentence for the underlying offense. After all, the order of probation says sentence withheld pending successful completion of probation. If you don't successfully complete probation, then that sword of Damocles is hanging over your head. And every defendant knows that. Every defense attorney tells his client, all right, you want probation? You've got that sword hanging over your head for 5 years or 10 years, however long the probationary term is. You may get the max if you don't shape up.
What would your argument be if, at the end of the line, this defendant didn't pay the fines and he went back before Judge Murphy, and Judge Murphy didn't behave as you think that he would based on what he said in the record thus far, and he imposed a full 10 years, and then it was appealed and it came up here, and the defendant was arguing that that was impermissible because he had a jail alternative of 96 days and a maximum statutory term of exposure of 6 months, and that ought to have capped his liability for non-payment of the fine, and the 10 years was therefore impermissible. What would your answer be then?
Well, I think in that case, we probably would have, the defendant would have a pretty good argument of an erroneous exercise of sentencing discretion, because when you look at Judge Murphy's comments at the post-conviction hearing, he makes it plain as day that he intended to give Mr. Oakley these alternative choices.
But
and if Mr. Oakley chooses the second alternative, I don't see how Judge Murphy could backtrack.
He changed his mind because he found the defendant's contemptuous attitude over the course of this additional 3 years that he was giving him to pay the fine was so egregious that it deserved the full 10 years, and he totally justifies that on the record by saying all the right things to withstand an abuse of discretion attack, which is a very narrow standard of review for sentencing.
Well, I mean,
would that be a constitutional violation?
You might run into North Carolina v. Pierce, but even under those circumstances, a judge can increase a sentence if there are intervening factors that weren't known at the time of sentencing that would justify increasing it, if something else came down the line.
To me, your answer should be that although he said that on the record when he signed the sentence, not the 96 days aren't there. It's just a flat. Isn't that right? Do I have the four facts wrong?
Well, I think there must have been. I think the 96 days, and I think it's conceded, refers to some jail alternative that was imposed at the time the fines were imposed for the prior offenses, and certainly the statute caps his liability for non-payment of the fine at 6 months.
But what did the final order say as to his sentence? Did it say 96 days? If he didn't agree, no. I mean,
you'd have to ask the defendant that, and he is not disputing that. And so he's the one responsible for this record, and frankly, this record is lacking a lot. And being the petitioner in this case, I think it's his responsibility to explain where this comes from. I was operating the assumption there's no dispute that he must serve 96 days as his commitment, that these prior offenses, one of which appears to have been a civil offense.
Then the defendant ought to say, okay, 96 days, that's shorter than 180 days. Is that right? Six months times 30, you ought to say he's got a good deal. What's he doing up here?
He's got a good deal, and Judge Murphy offered him an even better deal, and he continues to reject it. Thank you.
I have another question. I don't know that Hain is the correct case to rely on. In Hain, that burglary equipment, everybody agreed, did not fit under the restitution statute. Isn't that right?
Well, I think the opinion basically said whether or not it fits under the restitution statute as clearly as a reasonable appropriate...
Well, the state conceded in Hain it didn't fit under restitution.
Right, but the court, I think, made it clear that we're, you know, I think the majority said, we're not sure, but we need not reach that issue. And the majority relied on the Court of Appeals decision in Connolly, which dealt with the drug buy money situation, where, again, the rather than try to fit it under restitution or cost statutes, the Court of Appeals said, well, whether or not it fits under those provisions, it clearly is a reasonable, appropriate condition of probation in this case.
Yes,
so
but we agree with the state's contention that even if Hain is required to pay $4,000 for the burglary, it's not victim restitution. The requirement may nevertheless be upheld if it's reasonable and appropriate. In this case, the fine does come under a specific statute. I think it's arguable. And so that Hain may not apply. Because there, they had a restitution, and it required certain conditions, but it didn't prohibit other aspects of restitution if you didn't call it restitution.
But I guess...
In this case, you've got specific statutes that say what happens when a fine is not paid.
But Hain quoted Connolly as saying that the restitution provision and the reasonable appropriate condition of probation provision are not mutually exclusive. They are consistent. They are cumulative. I can't remember the exact phraseology, but Hain directly quoted the Connolly language, saying that these statutes are in harmony. They do not limit each other. They expand each other. And I would suggest that when the legislature doesn't authorize restitution or fines or costs at all, and the court holds it's nonetheless a reasonable appropriate condition of probation, that is an even broader authority than when the legislature expressly does authorize fines, costs, and restitution, and yet this court says, and as an alternative, it can be imposed as a reasonable and appropriate condition of probation.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Mr. Kay, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. Just a comment on one aspect that the Attorney General's office brought up. There was a statement or a reference that there was some highly consistent activity between the defendant's intimidation and the OAR and disorderly conduct type matters. And if there was some highly consistent relationship between, I would agree with the Attorney General's office the notion that if it is consistent and it's similar and serves to rehabilitate directly for that defendant or to further deter him from unrelated or to deter him from future potential criminal activity, I would agree. But in this case, they are not highly consistent. They could not be further apart.
Would your argument be the same if the sentence for which, or the conviction for which he is, Mr. Oakley is being sentenced for, was one that called for a 30-day imprisonment, up to 30 days, so that the maximum that he could get if he failed to fulfill a condition of probation was 30 days? Would you be making the same arguments?
No. Because
so that what I'm trying to get at is...
Why not?
Yeah.
To serve the 30 days could be his penalty under the felony conviction. That would.
So does your whole case turn on the potential 10 years?
No, the case turns on the unrelatedness.
I'm in my example, the misdemeanor is totally unrelated to some, maybe he failed to pay a couple parking tickets or something.
Okay.
What I'm trying to get at, counsel, is how much does your case depend upon the fact that this exposes him to 10 years as opposed to the 97 days or whatever it is that the failure to pay a fine statute calls for?
Well, if he was only exposed to 96 days or the 6 months, and if that's the way the order of the judgment of the court had been entered, he would probably agree to that. We wouldn't even be here. But it doesn't say that. It's because they're unrelated matters, and because they're unrelated, he doesn't get the 96 days or 6 months. He is exposed to 10 years. Honors.
Well, then we should we remand this back to find out what Judge Murphy meant in opposing counsel indicates that he thought there was no question. 96 days was it. He indicates that that was what he thought the record was.
That could happen, and I would further hypothesize that if trial counsel were in that situation, they would probably stipulate to 96 days be an appropriate alternative for failing to pay something. But 10 years exposure, it's just way too much. It's just unconscionable.
Yeah, so in answer to Judge Justice Babbage's question, 10 years is a looming large argument.
Yes.
Well, here's the amended judgment of conviction. It says conditions of sentence. This is record 26. Conditions of sentencing. It says sentence date 10/20/97, withheld probation order. It says 3 years length. Then it says fine, $10, court cost $64.80, etc. Conditions, jail time 6 months. Then it says, with Huber, 2 months, et cetera. And then it says, miscellaneous conditions. And then it says, other. Pay OS, is that outstanding?
Correct.
Fines. And there's a number, which I assume relates to the other case, but I don't know. And then it says, attorney fees. That's all this says. Is that your point, that the 96 days isn't set forth here?
Correct. It may be what the judgment with the 96 days was just for the $10 fine plus the court cost. Maybe that was the alternative on that.
Let's see. It says, why do you think that's only limited to 10 days? The court says here we typically throw back fines and in on probation conditions, benefits the defendant. We find that overall it seems to help them to pay back fines, and because the alternative is up the minimum to the county jail, that's 96 days, unless he coughs up the money, right?
That's in quote.
We've chosen not to do that, but that would be Opie's preference to serve 96 days and still owe us the money. That's what the point just Brad was making. That could be arranged, but I'd give him a chance over 3 years to pay. Now, what's, you think that only relates to the $10?
Correct.
Okay.
It makes sense that way.
And under any conditions, it doesn't appear in the judgment or conviction.
Correct.
Okay.
My time has expired.
Well, so is your answer to Justice Babbage that if it was 96 days for all of these fines, that you wouldn't have been here? You would just take his 96 days?
If it was 96 days for this $10 forfeiture, whatever.
Where do you see that?
It says obligations under fine $10, court cost $64.80, other $10, mandatory surcharge $70. So presumably, the judge could have been stating the alternative for failing to pay on this judgment of conviction before the court could have been 96 days. I think what the trial judge was doing was taking the math of the higher fine, dividing by 25, and coming up with 96.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. And that concludes our hearing on this case. We are in recess until 1:45, at which time we'll hear our third.